We go. So one of the, there's been a lot of literature that's been produced about and in the wake of this coronavirus crisis. There's especially a lot of halachic writing. You know, what do we do, you know, Zoom seders, and what do we do in terms of all sorts of halachic issues of other sorts. There's really been a lot written, and I think that there's been a bit less on the theological side of things, on the hashkafa. And I thought for this year, maybe it would be worth looking into some of the theological sides of this. Really, as I said, there isn't too much out there, but there are a few things, and we're going to focus on sort of the question of tefillah, of prayer, and how that interacts with simcha, with times of happiness, and with times of avelut, of mourning, and you know, sort of how those all work together, how those triangulate when you have issues of when you have obviously a time of great crisis and you have other halachic categories that and how they interact. So anyway, with that long-winded introduction, I'm going to do the share screen thing. So here we go. So hopefully you're all in a second going to be seeing the handout. Yes. Good. Awesome. So yeah, so I thought it would make sense to start with what I thought was a very powerful, very important letter by Rav Moshe Lichtenstein of Yeshivat Har Etzion, one of the Rosh Yeshiva, about where he really takes this on directly, the question of how to understand our time from a theological perspective and what ramifications that has on prayer, on just the general approach, etc. And it's a fairly long letter, so we're not going to read through all of it. We'll sort of jump around. But his main point is that, although there are often challenges, often crises that we face, as he writes, this distress is different, a vague but consistent unease in the depths of the soul. This is somehow different. This is more, this is greater, more overwhelming than what we've seen in recent years. And it's not just the fact that it's more difficult in a specific sort of way, that there's greater challenges. But one of the problems is the difficulty of holding on to routine. Because very often when we feel threatened, he writes, we hold on to routine as an emotional respite. We go back to what we know, and that's a great way of coping. But of course, the nature of the challenge of coronavirus and the social distancing that's been enacted in its wake is that people can't continue as normal, that people have to be separated from each other, that we have to close down our shuls, our schools, our universities, all of our social contexts, including religious contexts. And there's a challenge there, both in the practical sense that the comfort for that is missing, but also there's a theological challenge. As Rav Moshe writes, modern man views the natural order as a positive and beneficial force, and normative life sponsored by the natural world as safe. And you know, humanity has learned how to use nature to support our needs. And generally, the crisis that we face is deviation from nature, things like war, disaster, economic crisis, and nature is generally seen as a safe thing. But in this case, he writes, nature and modern lifestyle have turned against us, like a harnessed bull turning on its master. It's a world turned upside down, and this state shakes our equilibrium and undermines our existence. Man has lost his anchor and knows not how to navigate his own world. This is, I think, a great account of the experience of living under coronavirus, but there are further ramifications of that. It's more than just the diagnosis. This change carries significant spiritual ramifications. It gives the mashal, the parable of a child lost in the mall. The mall can be fun, but when you're lost, when you don't know where you're going, it's a real crisis and there's real danger. And what one naturally does is to cry out for one's parent. And he says, we are this child. In our present reality, we're threatened by the dangers of the pandemic, frightened by an unfamiliar world, fear of danger, dread of the unfamiliar, loss of routine. That's all reflected in our souls, and we cry to our Father. So there's some special nature, some special aspect of this tefillah, of this prayer, that we're naturally bound to do in reaction to this. And he talks about the difference between the first two brachas of Shmon Esrei, God who functions through nature, which is the first bracha, Hagadol Hagibor, versus the second bracha, or Hagadol versus Hagibor, the second bracha, Ata Gibor, that's about God overriding nature, and that's why it's about Tchias Hamesim, resurrection of the dead, which is going against nature. But the usual comfort we take in God as functioning within nature, as having created nature, is less relevant here. And instead, we're finding nature fighting against us, and we need to call on God to again override nature, to conquer nature in defending us. So that's more of a pure, theoretical point here. And he says it's supposed to apply itself in the following way. The dichotomy of greatness and might when standing before God in prayer is expressed halachically in the division between brachos and tannis. Both relate to prayer, but one discusses routine everyday prayer, while the other delves into prayer practiced, it's a typo, I think, from the original email, practiced in a time of crisis. And there's a real difference here. Brachos, you turn to God as the creator and turn to God and thank God for creating the natural order. Whereas a tannis, one asks for God to try to overcome the natural order and in support of us. And he says, we're very used to, in our normal circumstance, to relating to God as the creator of nature, and everything works so well generally, big picture, things work well within the natural order. We thank God for what he created. And now all of a sudden, part of the theological nature of this crisis is that we're now seeing nature turned against us. And relating to God has to change as well. It has to be more of a tannis, more of a fast-like, more of a crisis mode, relating to God rather than the usual prayer as thanking God for what happens. So he says this explicitly, over the last few weeks, reality has changed, and this demands a parallel change in our emotional world, in prayer, and in religious experience. Right? It would be inappropriate to say, okay, phenomenologically, experientially, this has changed, but that has no ramification on prayer. That's not the right way to do things. There's really a need to internalize that sense and reflect it in one's prayer. And he ties this in with his grandfather, the Rav, Rabbi Soloveitchik, who talks about a man conquering the world using technology, which allows for control over the universe. And this is the opposite of that. This is now trying to fight, instead of harnessing nature, to try to fight against it, to stop it in its tracks. And he says that this sort of prayer of trying to fight against nature fits very well with the Avinu Malkeinu and the Misha Ana, which he says people should include this daily. He makes that as a specific suggestion. We'll come back to that in a minute. And he writes, in this context, these prayers of in Tannis are based on an acute sense of danger, based on that threat from nature. And now he turns to some of the ramifications in terms of Psak. And I think we'll see, we're going to be focusing largely on the ramifications because I think few people have direct theological treatments like the one we just read, and you sort of have to squeeze it out of the meta-halachic data. So he says, here are his suggestions. The ramifications on the policy of Psak need to be determined. And he says, one of the primary approaches to current halachic questions attempts to maintain a familiar routine to whatever extent possible, and is willing to be lenient to achieve this end. So one method, one approach that some people have in responding to the crisis is make everything as close to normal as possible. We can't daven in shuls, so have a Zoom minion, even though it doesn't count for a minion halachically, but it'll feel a bit like a minion. People will have that sense of comfort. And the fact that it approximates it, that's an important thing we should do. Or find all sorts of other ways to keep that routine, to keep that sense of comfort. He says familiar routine is a comfort, but when the world order has turned upside down, the objective should not be to seek calm or comfort, but rather to face reality and understand that our relationship with the world around us has shifted. We must recognize the crisis and make the necessary spiritual adjustments. So Rav Moshe rejects this idea, which I think many, many people have been following, especially in the United States. That's been my sense. Rav Moshe says, we really reject this conception. And the moment is a time of crisis, and the response needs to be one that reflects that sense. Instead of trying to wish away the new realities, you need to sort of lean into it to admit that this is a time of crisis, and to have prayer and to have ritual and to have Judaism respond in that way. He writes, the aspiration to execute a halachic policy which strives to maintain routine is not a question relating to a specific halachic detail, nor is it a general question of leniency or stringency in policy. Right? This isn't about detail, this isn't about chumrah or kula, but rather a fundamental question of whether the crisis should be acknowledged and the aspiration to return to that which is familiar and the routine abandoned. The world has changed and this must be acknowledged. So really he's making this meta-halachic point, or really a theological point, that And I think he presents it as two views. I think there's really three possible positions one could take. Right? One might say, I'm going to go out of my way to maintain normalcy, to maintain the usual structures as much as possible. One might go in the opposite direction, as Ramosha is, and say, I'm willing to go out of my way to try to embrace the fact that things are different. And there's sort of the more default position, which is, I'm just going to go with the flow. I'm going to pretend nothing happened and let the halachic chips fall where they may. So he's sort of grouping together the two views that he disagrees with. But I think, his view is the outlier more, the one that takes a clearer stand. And he throws in at the end another line that I thought was helpful in response to what I've seen a lot of people have these give these shiurim, these lectures where they say, oh, it's terrible. It's terrible that people are dying. But isn't it wonderful that now we recognize that things are unpredictable and God, God runs the world? And he says, I'd like to emphasize, I don't believe fear of epidemic and disease are necessary to enhance the sense of man's dependence on God. Right? It shouldn't be that. I mean, I think he doesn't say this explicitly. Maybe this is me talking more, but there's a little bit of a distastefulness of it, sort of the reveling in the crisis. But even beyond that, you shouldn't need a global pandemic to understand one's reliance on God. Of course, it's challenging. I mean, I think you could read this piece and say precisely that. Maybe you do need that. Maybe things are too comfortable under normal circumstances and it's so difficult. But Rav Moshe doesn't want to go in that direction. In any event, I think this is an extremely helpful framing. Not only is it its own theological view, but it's also a very helpful framing for some of the questions that different poskim and different thinkers have faced here in responding to coronavirus. Is the goal to keep things as much as possible the same and try to minimize any distinctions? Is the goal to emphasize the distinctions? And one way that plays itself out a lot, because on a day-to-day basis, it's often hard to see. But when you have things like mourning and things like rejoicing, calendar, places on the calendar where things are supposed to shift, how does that play itself out? Do you have is your Nisan a full Nisan? Is your Pesach a full Pesach? Is your Sfira Avelis a full Avelis or not? So I think Rav Moshe sets up the stakes in a very helpful way, and we'll explore beyond his own view. We'll explore a handful of other views and other issues where this expresses itself. As I said, my sense is that many shul rabbis and poskim and influential people in the American Orthodox community have emphasized trying to maintain a sense of normalcy, a sense of continuity. You don't often find explicit formulations of it. It's sort of the basic assumption, the background behind a lot of what's going on. But one place I found, at least a fairly clear formulation of this, Rabbi Yaakov Taubes, a friend of mine, another former JLIC rabbi. He was at Penn for a bunch of years. Now he's the rabbi at Mount Sinai Jewish Center. And, he points to a similar diagnosis to that of Rav Moshe. That and this is March 27. This is already a month ago, but this was true then too. Soon after shuls had closed, for many of us, finding Hashem in these extraordinary times has gotten harder, not easier. Without our shul, our friends, indeed without everything that helps make a religious life worth pursuing for so many, connecting to Him has become more difficult. Davening at home, observing Shabbos without community, not seeing anyone, these can be impediments to achieving and enhancing proper Yiras Shamayim. So he's pointing to, I think, the phenomenology that many people are feeling, and that Rav Moshe pointed to as well. Without the social structures, without the institutions that usually are in place, it can be a lot harder to feel a part of the Jewish rhythms. He also talks about how people are looking at their phones for the latest news, and that's the place to look for hope. And that's almost a replacement for God, which is an interesting note. But here he goes to one aspect of how this plays itself out, one ramification. And he says, this past Thursday was Rosh Chodesh Nisan, the beginning of the month of redemption. Usually, that's when you stop saying Tachanun. And he said, Rav Herschel Schechter was asked whether we should perhaps say Tachanun during Nisan this year, in light of the troubling times. And he said, Tachanun's omitted because we remember the redemption from Egypt and look forward to a future redemption. And the significance of these ideas remains in place despite everything going on at present. So the idea is there are bigger factors at stake here, right? It's not about right now, what's going on right now and the challenges people face. think big picture. Think, go back 3,000 years to Mitzrayim, go forward to the Mashiach. That's what Nisan's about. Nisan, you know, isn't really impacted at all by what's going on now. It's still the month of the Chodesh HaGeula, the month of redemption. And just incidentally, you see, you know, I've seen many people invoke the idea that Nisan's a time of redemption, and people saying, well, maybe this is, maybe Mashiach's coming over Pesach. You know, someone even gave a shiur on that very topic, saying, what happens if Mashiach doesn't come over? What happens if Mashiach doesn't show up, you know? And pointing to some of the dangers of messianism that's so directed and so focused. You know, there's a reason why the Rambam said, "Tipachna atzmosam shel mechashvei kitzim," that, you know, it's not a good idea to be calculating the end, because it can really backfire in a massive way. But, you know, I think this is not that. This is a very different point, which is that Nisan maintains its stature. Nisan maintains its status as a time of redemption, of enjoying, of celebrating the redemption. And despite the fact that there are crises now, that doesn't affect the basic calculus. And as the Reitelis closes, our world has been turned upside down, but it nonetheless is time to get ready for Pesach, and that's what we're going to do. This idea of routine, to reorient, to focus, and focus on Yom Tov, prepare for it. That's the sense of routine, to look for comfort, which again, I think is representative of many, many, many American communities, and is the exact opposite of what Rav Moshe's theological suggestion was. So I think there's a lot to think about here just in terms of the basic theology. Maybe we'll stop for some questions, some discussion now, if I'm sure you all have thoughts, and then we'll jump into some of the weeds, some of the details. Okay, so maybe we should jump into some more of the sources. Go. So let's start by talking about what happens when Nisan falls out during coronavirus. And you might have thought to put that in the opposite direction, but I think I did it this way intentionally, because you know, if we're thinking about coronavirus as a phenomenon, then the different nafka minas, the different ramifications would be, or sort of the episodic things that sort of happen. So, you know, we have a period of coronavirus, and Nisan fell out a couple of weeks in. So what do you do? So there are halachic precedents for not exactly this, but for similar things. Usually during Nisan, we don't say Tachanun, because as we saw in the letter, it's generally it's the time of Geula, it's a time of redemption, and we don't, you know, we're happier and we don't say Tachanun. But even times that are even happier than Nisan, the Mishnah says, Al Elu Masrin B'Shabbos, Al Ir Shigifu Agayim O'Nahar, Aval Sfina M'Shravis Bayam, on these moments of crisis where you have a city surrounded or a river, people are under attack, or a ship out at sea, here we can allow for tefilos, cries out, and tefilos that we usually wouldn't. And you can even blow the masrim, you can even blow the shofar, the chatzotzros in that case. And Rabbi Yossi Omer Le'ezra Avalo Le'Za'aka. You can blow the trumpets to help them, to try to rally the troops, but not for tefillah. So there's a bit of a question here as to whether you can blow trumpets for the sake of tefillah on Shabbos, which is obviously much higher stakes than saying Tachanun during Nisan, both because it's Shabbos as opposed to Nisan, and because it's, you know, a potential violation of Shabbos, albeit a Durabanan. But the Rambam paskins this, and I think this can be applied very well too. In Gozrin Tanis Alat Tzibur Lo B'Shabbos V'Lo B'Yomim Tovim, we don't usually have communal fasts on Shabbos or Yom Tov. V'chein in Tokim B'Yom Lo B'Shofar Lo Chatzotzos Lo Zoakim V'Mishchanim B'Hem B'Tfilah. We don't call out or blow shofar in Tfilah. Ela Im Kain Ha'Seir Shigifua Akamo Nahar Osfina Mitravis B'Yom. Unless you have a crisis of a group that's under attack, or either under attack from other people or under attack from nature, right, about to drown. So what would you say? What would you say if you wanted to apply it to here, to our case? So there's an argument to be made, and we'll skip number five for now. Jump to number six. Rav Moshe Lichtenstein, actually in a separate letter he wrote, and when he was asked about this, says, "Well, you know, you apply these halachos here. You apply the rules, the usual rules of crisis mode, which are different than your usual year." So he says, "I'm definitely of the opinion that one should continue to say Avinu Malkeinu and Tachanun in Chodesh Nisan as well." And he says there's a halachic case for this, but that's not the main reason. The real reason is that there's a compelling religious and emotional need to do so. If in times like this we don't cry out to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, then when should we do so? Right? This is the ultimate Eis Tzara. If Eis Tzara allows for davening and crying out and maybe even blowing shofar on Shabbos and Yom Tov, then definitely this is the biggest Eis Tzara we've seen in a long time. And it should certainly allow for saying Tachanun, saying Avinu Malkeinu during Nisan. I should add, of course, there's the question about whether to say Avinu Malkeinu or not. I think a lot of people have advocated at least that much changing tefillah, whether to say the classic Avinu Malkeinu after Shmon Esrei at Shacharis and Mincha, or whether to have like the one line Avinu Malkeinu Zchor Hamecho Chosh Kascha V'Chali Dever V'Chari Rav in Shomayat Tefillah Shmon Esrei. I think most people are advocating adding some tefillah, but the question is how far that goes, right? And do you even do it during Nisan when there's at least a reason not to? And Rav Moshe says, of course, this is a moment of crisis. There's halachic basis and there's hashkafic basis, even more importantly. How can you not cry out to God in the time of such crisis? And now a little psychoanalysis of the other side, so to speak. I have been wondering why there is such a deep reluctance, among others, to adopt a crisis mode in tefillah when everything else in our lives is in an unprecedented crisis mode. Is it only a halachic conservatism and reluctance to deviate from conventional sources, or is it something much deeper? The question is heightened by the contrast to the halachic landscape in which, to the best of my impression, there is a recognition that these are special times with special needs and a much greater willingness to paskin out of the box, while the attitude to tefillah is not so. So it's a fascinating point where he's saying that on halachic issues, poskim are very willing to be lenient. Again, with some limitations, but overall are willing to be lenient. But in terms of theology, in terms of what davening looks like, what prayer looks like, all of a sudden people have become very conservative. And maybe maybe it's making life easy for people, but maybe it's also something beneath the surface. Maybe there's some deep-seated fear of admitting that the crisis is as bad as it is. He says, personally, I was astounded. If the Mishnah in Tainus and the idea of fasting in an Eis Tzara doesn't apply to this situation, when then is it applicable? It's right. It should apply now, if ever. And jumping down, I believe there is an emotional and religious unwillingness to admit the true extent of the crisis and to behave accordingly, and that this creates a very unhealthy disconnect between our medical and practical behavior and our religious awareness. And I think he's pointing here, there's a real cost to this, right? If you're unwilling to admit that it's an Eis Tzara in terms of the rules of davening, and you're only treating it as an Eis Tzara in terms of, your every other practice, in terms of shutting down all your institutions, you're disconnecting between tefillah and real life. And that can't help the nature of your prayer if you're disconnecting it from your day-to-day. He adds, all the attempts to seek the positive and to emphasize the normal can only be legitimate if they follow a deep and sincere recognition of our situation as a crisis, rather than attempting to ward it off or paper it over. And he adds the halachic piece. He says, Nere Pasha Diesh Lahamshich Be'amir Asavino Alkeinu Hashana V'chein Lomar Tachanun Mechodesh Nisan. Continue saying Avinu Alkeinu, continue saying Tachanun. Why? He says, and this is a much longer conversation, but he says, Mitzvah Tefillah Doraisa Be'eis Tzara Mechayevis Tefillah HaMeshakeves, it's hard to do this in a non-Israeli accent, HaMeshakeves Es Eis Tzara Skuvaso Aleha. Right, there's a The obligation to pray normally, on some views, is only rabbinic, is only derabbanan. The obligation to pray in an Eis Tzara, in a time of crisis, is biblical, is daraisa. And not only that, but the quality, not only is the level higher, the quality is particular. You need to daven in a certain manner. V'nira, she'im yispalo be'eis tzares tfilaso haragila, kemitzas anashim ilumada. If you give your usual prayer, sort of, just mumble the usual thing that you do every other day, lo yishtakef ba'eis tzara, and you're not reflecting in it, the time of crisis, in your prayer, azai ke mitzvah tefillah shebechol yom, ach lo mitzvah tefillah be'eis tzara. You may have fulfilled your daily obligation to prayer, the derabbanan, but you've missed out on the crisis mode of prayer. So I think he formulates this very strongly, that it not only is there reason to continue davening, there's a specific obligation, the usual obligation that in the Rambam passing this, I didn't cite it, but Mitzvah lizokulah rial kol tzar shvitzar shlo tavalat zibur, that whenever there's a crisis, there's a biblical obligation to cry out to God. And if you just say your normal davening, that's not going to cut it. You're not going to fulfill that special obligation of prayer in a time of crisis. That's Rav Moshe's view. Rav Schechter's view, which was cited before, another formulation here. We were asked about Chodesh Nisan. We usually have Tachanun, Rav Shai Schechter, Rav Schechter's son. sent out from his father's name, Rav Schechter feels that Avinu Malkeinu should not be recited during Chodesh Nisan, as it has always been considered to be a Chodesh HaGeula. Tachanun is not recited, nor should Avinu Malkeinu. So you're saying, that this view is saying, this year is no different than last year, is no different than next year, in terms of the rules of tefillah. It's a fundamentally different view. And again, it has what to say for it. It has what to support it, which is that you want to maintain a sense of normalcy. You don't want to have exceptions everywhere. But Rav Moshe's critique, I think, is aimed precisely at this sort of view. Just, I found it interesting. Rav Moshe is not alone on this. I cut and pasted from a Pashkvil, you know, those signs they put up in Mea Sharim and elsewhere, from the Eda Haredis, the Arch Haredi institution in Yerushalayim. And they have a whole list of recommendations of what to do in the Tzar, in the Meitzar, in the Meitzar Karanu, how we pray out to God, what to do. And this is Dalad Nisan before Pesach. One of the things they say, Legami Tila Vitzibra Minyan, and they say the Minyanim should make sure to follow the rules of the doctors and separate, etc. Yomar is called Seder Atfila Ala Seder. You should say the entire usual structure of prayer on, you know, in order. Kolel Avinu Malkeinu, including Avinu Malkeinu, Yechashad Lo Ki'ilu Hispalo B'Minyan. If you're not doing it, even if you're doing it at home, if you do it at the right time, it counts as if it's a minyan. But the point for our purposes is with Avinu Malkeinu, and they sent this out on Dalad Nisan. So obviously their interest was for people to continue saying Avinu Malkeinu, rather, despite the fact that it was Nisan. So they're on that side of things. My sense is most American shuls, as far as I could tell, did not. So that's our first test case. Another test case, relatedly, is what happens when Pesach falls out during coronavirus. My understanding is every year that Nisan falls out during coronavirus, Pesach also falls out during coronavirus. That's been my experience, at least. So what do you do about certain aspects of the Seder night that seem off? And maybe the most obvious one is Kol Dichvin. We have, it's sort of pro forma, but what we're explicitly doing at the Seder is we're inviting anyone who wants to come in. Now, go back 3 weeks in your head. If someone knocked on your door and said, I really need a Seder, I have nowhere to go, would you let them in? You know, probably the health recommendation would be absolutely not to let them in. In fact, there were letters going around from every institution that I know of, in America, certainly, that people shouldn't travel to their own family at all. No one should visit anyone for Pesach, shouldn't join together households. That was very much the view. So what does it mean to invite people in to your house? So we'll just read the Hebrew, because that's the original. Here, Rav Schechter's answer, B'tchilas ha-seder mazminim es ha-aniyim le'chol itanu, we invite the poor to eat with us. V'matzav shelanu shel sakanas magefa, we're not letting anyone in. We still say this text. You're not actually inviting anyone. It's not a genuine invitation ever. If people show up, maybe you let them in. But what you're really doing is you're memorializing what happened in the time of the Mikdash. Fine, he points that out, and we don't actually open the door. You're not really inviting people. Then they added on the lines of Hashanat Avdei, Lashana Baba Mechor, etc. That's not part of the original formulation. We continue this to memorialize the Mikdash. So, again, continue the usual structures. There's a logical reason for it. There's a sort of formalistic reason that the original text was not meant to actually invite people. It was meant to just to maintain the original practice. And there's no reason to do it any differently this year. On the other hand, some have suggested trying to change things a bit, trying to mix things up a little bit. Rabbi David Block, who's in LA, principal of school in LA, so he wrote an article actually at the Lair House. So thank you for the shout out before Nettie. That he writes that, he talks about how in the time of the Holocaust, to tie into one of the questions before about previous parallels, in the Holocaust there was a new formulation that people came up with on Achilas Chametz. Right? People, tragically were starving in the ghettos and in the camps. This is Bergen-Belsen, and there was no question. Obviously, you eat whatever you can eat. There's no question of maybe if you can smuggle in a matzah, if somehow you do that. But no one's not going to eat Chametz on Pesach if they're starving. And this account, published by Mordechai Eliyav, Everyone before eating their chametz, say with full kavana. Our will is to do your will. To celebrate Pesach by eating matzah and not eating chametz. But we're in great pain that we're in danger for our lives. We want to fulfill the mitzvah of preserving our lives. Amen. And they say this bracha before eating their chametz. Very powerful, very poignant. And Rabbi Block said not to compare our situation to the Holocaust, because it's, you know, obviously we're in a terrible situation, but the scale is not at all comparable, and the situation is not at all comparable. But given that there are some differences in our Pesach, we're set to begin a holiday bereft of some of the elements that are core to our celebration. No family, no shul, we can't invite people in. So it's natural to feel a sense of sadness and disappointment. And he suggests that we should mourn the loss. Obviously, that's in quotes. It's not halachic mourning. It's not the sort of mourning that's usually usher on Yom Tov. But we should say we should not only mourn that, but also shift the sadness of what we aren't doing to simcha, to try to enjoy what we are doing. And he offered a modified version of that prayer, of that tefillah from Bergen-Belsen. And we'll just read the English quickly. O Father in heaven, it's open and known before you. It's our will to do your will. We want to celebrate Pesach with our communities, with our friends, to pray together, to take care of the elderly, to say kol dichvin yesevi echol, kol dichrich yesevi esaf, to invite people in, in a genuine invitation. With aching hearts, we must realize that our current precautions prevents us because of sakanat nefashot. We're prepared to fulfill your commandment of v'chai behem, which of course, you know, in a slightly different way. Here, it's not about eating chametz on Pesach. Here, it's about socially distancing on Pesach. But he retains that from the original formulation. And we pray to you that you maintain us in life, hasten to redeem us, so we can do your will with a perfect heart. Amen. I think this is not exactly the same as Rav Moshe's idea, but a very parallel idea, that we're living in a moment of crisis, things are different, and instead of avoiding that, instead of trying to sort of flatten the experience to the normal one, the goal instead should be to lean into the differences and to embrace them, not necessarily to, you know, from a sense of sadness, or although there's some of that, but to try to refocus it as the right thing to do. And actually a colleague of his, Rabbi Yitzchak Etshalom, also offers some new prayers to state, one before Halach Ma'anya, with some nice parallels. Da'achlinan b'segirusa, we're eating it in solitude, and Kol Yitzchak Yisev Yitzvach can call out for help instead of Yifsach to have the Pesach. Nice punning and use of language there. And similarly, another prayer before Hallel, that the singing is going to be muted and with a smaller group, and hopefully we'll be able in the future to have prayers on a grander scale. So I think these views, this is really an attempt to change the nature of what experiencing Pesach, of what experiencing the Seder is like, given our circumstance. And then the third main case study here is what happens when Sfira falls out during coronavirus. Now there's sort of this built-in unusual structure to our calendar, which is theoretically Sfira starts during Chol HaMoed and continues during Pesach, and then it goes into continues during Nissan, and goes then when you get into by the time you go into Iyar, you're well into Sfira. And if Sfira is a time of mourning and Nisan is a time of Geula, there's sort of an inherent contradiction or something approaching that. So that's always unusual. And there were debates over Yom HaShoah. You can't have Yom HaShoah during Nisan, because Nisan's a time of happiness. Yom HaShoah is a time of sadness. And then a week later, you can't have Yom HaTzmaut during Sfira, because Sfira is a time of sadness. Very unusual, because the calendar pulls in both directions simultaneously. But leaving that aside, what about this year? What about when Sfira falls out during coronavirus? So Rav Schechter put out a psak in order to reduce, I'm just reading the English in the short version, in order to reduce some of the depressing atmosphere, this was the question, can we allow dispensation for the Isra of music, at least the recorded kind? It's not clear how problematic recorded music is altogether. Maybe this year we can make Nehekil. Rav Schechter said, it's a minhag not to listen during Sfira. That is a minhag. it's self-understood that a minute doesn't apply under such unusual circumstances, and this would be the same. So, and people ask, do you need to make a heter nedarim, this would be matir neder. You don't need to be matir neder because the assumption is minhagim, which may have the power of neder, were never accepted under unusual circumstances. Just to look at the formulation here, we'll just do the English quickly. During this time of global suffering, it would appear that for some individuals, refraining from listening to or playing music may leave one in a state of sadness or emotional distress. Now note, he's not talking about pikuach nefesh or anything approaching it. He's not talking about danger. It's just, it's hard for people. It's hard for some people to not have music. This would appear to reach beyond the intent of this restriction. The original minhag was never to cause pain or cause difficulty in this way. And if the motivation to listen to music is not to put oneself in a cheerful mood, but rather to ease the tension or pressure in one's home or help oneself, that would be permissible. One should still avoid listening to very cheerful music. Fine. And he says the same applies even during Shiva. So this is a fairly wide-ranging heter, again, which someone might apply next year too, right? To say that if it's really causing difficulty, it's not that you're missing out on something nice, but it's a real difficulty, maybe we should do away with Svira. On the other hand, it's sort of a funny thing, because I was actually talking to Chana, to my wife, the other day, and she said, if you think about it, Svira actually is very, very similar and very parallel to social distancing, like to life of quarantine, right? You have like no haircuts, no concerts, no music with crowds, no weddings. That actually is the point of Svira, of the minhagim during Svira, of avoiding happiness. The whole point is to avoid joy in a group, right? Like dancing, rikud bimicholos, dancing with a circle, with a group of people. It's precisely the connection to other people that's prohibited. Now we're essentially very limited in the people that we physically directly interact with. And the outcome is relatively similar, and they're a very similar thing. So it's sort of interesting that the response here is, you might think these two like work together. They can streamline one another, and social distancing, you're unhappy around people. You're not around people. You don't have that sense of happiness. Sphere, you're supposed to have that sense of unhappiness. It's wonderful. They work together so nicely. And people have even remarked, if you understand the minhag is based on Rabbi Akiva's students who died of an epidemic, it's actually similar in its cause too. But again, Rav Shechter, I think fairly consistently, is of the view, and again, reflected by many, many American rabbinic leaders, that you don't want to cause too much difficulty. So here there's a leniency, which is interesting. In previous cases, there were cases of keeping the practice the same, despite the fact that there were different circumstances. Here, there's even a leniency of sorts to sort of adjust people's experience to normal, right? Instead of, because Sphira being, having the sadness of Sphira would be so much worse than usual, you almost need a leniency to reset it to normal. On the other hand, Rav Usher Weiss, just a few days ago, came out with a letter about music during Sphira, and he writes, someone asks whether he can matir, whether he can permit music, and he says, Eshlach lecha etzari, b'mashe nirli kem minhag b'krav tzibur nirchav, this wide-ranging minhag, gam yisrael rabbanim rabim, and many rabbis even, lehakel v'ofen goref, b'chol tchum, ekev machlas ha-corona. People are just saying, coronavirus, be makel on everything. It's that simple. Ela patras hanashim ilanachos b'pesach, you don't need to clean for Pesach, or as he says, the women don't need to clean for Pesach, not sure why men don't have to. Ve'ela yitiru es achilas ha-kitneos, some matir kinyos, ela hitiru es ha-dibur b'yom tov, derech ha-machshev le-kroveim, shemir ha-chakman im-tsam b'vidud, some allowed speaking over computers. And by the way, we didn't mention this before, but the Moroccan tshuva allowing for Zoom seders also is of the goal of keeping things as normal, right? It says we're so used to having seders with the whole family, with the grandparents, with the grandchildren. How can we not have that this year? So we'll allow for Zoom seders. It's obviously more complicated than that too. There's a lot to say, but part of what was driving them was this goal of having the experience be similar to every other year. And so ve'ela hitir lishdol prachim b'chol moed, you're allowed to plant on chol moed if it makes you happy or your kids happy. Kiyotze v'zeh b'tchumim rabim. That's the sense that we have, right? The more cool is the merrier. And he's not happy with this. Migamazo ain la kol mako mechol atzdak, has no place and there's no justification. Halo b'shas tzara anachnu. And there are the key words, right? Similar to Rav Moshe. We're in a time of crisis. B'shas tzara mutal kol echad Now, his formulation is slightly different than Rav Moshe. He doesn't say, in crisis mode, you should try to have your religiosity reflect the crisis. He doesn't exactly say that, but he says, we should have chumras, right? Usually you respond, at least in some communities, certainly in the Haredi world, you respond to crisis by intensifying your observance through chumras, not kulas, not leniencies. Mishum kach pashut, she'ein lahatir ba'ofen gori fuklalia es hanagina u'shmias muzika b'me'a sphere. You shouldn't allow playing or listening to music during sphere in any sort of across-the-board way. Some cases may warrant it. U'pashut shem ketotsam ya'bidna chavrati v'ha'histagris v'vatim yesh le'isha isha koshi nafshi ke'ein dikon. If someone's depressed, v'ayde shmias muzika dato tisyashe v'ala v'yimtza margol l'nafshu ha'so'era. Obviously, if you are really considered a chole at some level, if you have a you're actually in depression, there's room to allow for it. And maybe there are families where the kids are driving you crazy or going crazy or whatever, and you can calm them down, then maybe there's room for it. But certainly there's no broad-based heter here. And actually, if you look in the details, you read it closely, it's actually not that far off in terms of the position itself from Rav Schechter. They both say, if someone's having difficulty, if it's hard for the kids. There is, I think, some difference in the practical side, but also I think the larger difference is the framing, is the meta halacha that goes into it. So for Rav Asher Weiss, there should be no reason to emphasize kulas. If anything, we should be doing chumras. We should be trying to intensify, make things more difficult for ourselves in response to the crisis. Whereas for Rav Schechter, it sounded more like there was more room for kula overall. I as with so many other things for me recently, every thought I have is really based in a Facebook post that I previously had. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but it is what it is. So just to quickly look at this post from a few weeks back, I related to some of the factors that we talked about, but I threw in a few other ones. One, benching Gomel over Zoom. So I think this is a great case because if you say Gomel over Zoom, there's a halachi side of this too. Is it better to wait until shuls reopen, even if it takes a couple months, or to have Gomel over Zoom? Saying Gomel over Zoom, you have on the positive side, well, it in some ways it's trying to maintain a usual structure. We're all used to having Gomel in a large group of people and not waiting and not, but at the same time, doing it over Zoom experientially, and I participated as a as a respondent, and not as the person saying Gomel, but as someone responding amen to someone who did it over Zoom, and it's really a different experience. It feels very different. You feel like it's very nice that this person recovered from, in this case, coronavirus, and you're celebrating their recovery, but it also feels like it's being done under a case of social distancing, under a scenario of social distancing. It's a different experience per se, and maybe that's like the, I don't know, the sweet spot, somewhere in the middle between the two extremes of doing everything differently or trying to make everything the same. Here, you're more or less keeping the same structure, but with some important differences. There's also the question of, the new tefillos and maybe saying Tehillim daily. The OU has had this daily Tehillim, I think at 1 o'clock every day, which I think also is nice because on the one hand, we're used to saying Tehillim, so it's not that different than the norm. At the same time, when's the last time you said Tehillim over a computer with, hundreds and thousands of people? So it's a different, and that, I guess that's the OU plug, but that's not why I said it. It's experientially just a different sort of thing, and it's the scale is different and the scope is different. So and then the last thing I was just thinking about the other day, I haven't seen this at all, which is interesting, but I wonder if someone would suggest, just being Yom HaAtzmaut to say we usually celebrate Yom HaAtzmaut this year, given the crisis mode, we should do less. Now, a lot of people said, given practicality, it's difficult to celebrate in the same way. That certainly happened. But I don't know, I didn't see anyone who like leaned in ideologically and said, we should do less, we should have less of a Yom HaAtzmaut because of the nature of things, because of the crisis. But that might be another parallel issue to the ones we discussed here. So I think, this is a broad-based question of how to relate to crisis, how to respond to crisis, to sort of minimize it or to amplify it. And this plays itself out in prayer and tefillah and in a whole host of other areas relating to religious ritual, religious practice, tefillah, and how one celebrates and how one mourns in halacha. So there's a lot more to think about here. I'm happy to discuss with all of you. I'm sure you have some thoughts, but also I don't want to keep people later than they want. So the floor is open.